If you make that little oof noise every time you stand up, yeah, that's your knees talking. Go see Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief covered by Medicare, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Noon business lunch. Apparently generative AI empowering us consumers to splurge more. How? Well, Matt Adams, principal at Deloitte Consulting, specializing in retail, joins us right now. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the Noon Business Lunch.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
So I'm curious, is this people that are using like a ChatGPT or a Claude to discuss their finances and potential spending habits, and it is encouraging us maybe to spend more? Or is this generative AI built into websites that are selling us stuff already? Walk us through a little bit about what we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's actually a couple things. It does start with consumers just thinking about the tools that they have available to aid in their consumer journey, from finding inspiration, researching products and opportunities, researching deals, and ultimately just making that shopping journey a lot easier and enabling them to find the things that they really love to treat themselves.
Is it the AI feeding us what we want to hear, or is it simply if it's an easier journey to research, you're just more likely to get from point A to point B, meaning from interest point A to buying at point B?
Yeah, it's really more the latter. It is consumers really using it as part of a structural shift in their path to purchase. Thinking about, you know, where historically it's consumers using search engines and potentially social, we're seeing for people who splurge and find ways to treat themselves that social and use of generative AI are really kind of neck and neck at this point, which represents a really significant and quick change to how people are using Gen AI, and I'd say AI more broadly, to find the products that they want, really own in on something that's of interest to them, and find something that is as appealing and deal-oriented as possible as quickly as possible.
Put another way, so then the desire to splurge, let's say, exists in all of us in some way, and I know we're all different, but let's say the desire to splurge is there. Gen AI just helps us kind of get to actually execute the splurge, whereas a Google search or trying to figure it out, maybe even through physical shopping, doesn't get us quicker to the buying, to actually executing the splurge. Gen AI gets us there quicker.
That's exactly right. Huh. I'd say you're right. Consumers will always find ways to treat yourself. It's really 7 in 10 are splurging on something special every month. And those who are using generative AI are 61% more likely to splurge 3+ times a month and spend 93% more on their priciest treat. So it really, I think, does reflect that they're finding something that's more personalized and tailored to them through that interactive approach that Gen AI has to offer.
That's fascinating. Okay, so then the flip is, what do retailers do to take advantage? I don't think it's as simple as buying an ad in ChatGPT. I know that might be coming soon. Is it about putting as much information about your products somewhere on the internet so that when the generative AI scrapes from your website, it gives more information to consumers? Like, what do retailers do to take advantage of this?
Yeah, retailers are really adapting in three ways. One is making sure that the products that they offer, that their catalog is readable by AI.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of a difference in technical approach to make sure that you're not just surfacing product with images and things that appeal to consumers, but making it very easy for AI to digest, find, and resurface themselves. The second thing is adapting to motivational drivers. And what we found is consumers' interest in how they use AI really differs by demographics. So, for example, 18 to 34 shoppers are more impulse-driven, so urgency and novelty is appealing, whereas 35 to 54 are splurging on something that they've been eyeing for a while. And those aged 55-plus are really looking for that offer that they can't refuse, and they're value-driven. So if you can figure out how to adapt to those motivational drivers and surface product information in the right way based on those journeys and those demographic shifts or generational shifts, that's the second thing. And the third thing is really engaging AI to develop some closed loop measurement so that they can track customer paths and really understand and anticipate how they can reach consumers with what they're really looking for.
This is fascinating, Matt. I will have to pick your brain a little bit more another time, because I'm even wondering about the language you choose to write on your website, catering to it so that when AI scrapes it, it is there and presentable easily for the consumer who's trying to decide what to buy, that you hit the points that you want to hit, and you've got to be the one as the retailer to put that language in the body of the text. But Matt, I'm out of time. I appreciate it. We'll talk again soon, okay?
All right. Thanks, John.
It's a fascinating world. Principal at Deloitte Consulting, specializing in retail, Matt Adams. Okay. John Williams also often says, thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. I got that vibe a little bit from Scott Stein's article at CNET, editor at large, who wrote, "Google has so many new smart glasses coming soon, I wore them all." And Scott, at the end of it, I'd say, "So you don't have to." Welcome back to WGN, Scott.
Thank you. Good to be on.
Yeah, because I don't want to try them all. I don't want to do it. I'm going to trust you. First of all, I didn't know there were so many smart glasses down the road. I thought that these were tried and failed. Am I wrong?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Google Glass, you know, it was a long time ago for some, and for others, you know, memory still stands. They made these things in 2013 that, you know, creep people out, and smart glasses is the kind of thing that have come and gone. Meta's been getting, you know, a lot of the publicity, getting that back with Ray-Ban. But you are going to see a lot.
There's something, I'm going to put Scott down just for a second if we can reconnect him. There is something ironic talking about the advancing of technology, and I think we just need to reposition Scott's phone there. We'll give that a shot. But it is fascinating that, yeah, as he was saying, in 2013 you had the Google Glass, and it was much maligned in many ways. People made fun of it. And Scott, that humor that people had in Google Glass, I thought maybe might sink it, but I imagine AI, the smart glasses, they're going to add something different, right?
They are. And, you know, I'm actually talking to a pair right now, so I hope that is working. But there are a lot of companies that are going to be entering the space. Google is one of the big ones. Apple's expected to be making a pair at some point. Snap is going to be re-releasing a pair. There's still Meta making a lot with EssilorLuxottica, which is the biggest eyewear maker pretty much out there. What we're seeing is a lot of hardware advances, and then you go, what am I really using it for? And is it private? And is it good to use in public? Is it weird to use in public?
Right.
So those are all separate questions. But Google, what they're doing that's interesting is their AI services are deeply connected, as people know and are getting freaked out about, into all the other Google apps that are out there. And they're doing more of that. It's in search and mail. And if you're using AI, like Notebook LM, which is actually really useful, but it is AI, these glasses will tap into a lot of those, which the thing is, a lot of the Meta glasses and others used AI, but it didn't actually do that much with the rest of AI as the world is knowing it. So Google has an interesting way to connect it with your phone. Apple is most likely going to do the same. But the question with Google still remains about privacy, data privacy, where AI and your data get responsibly handled. And Google's going to get into more of those details, apparently, when these glasses launch later this year. But for all companies dealing with AI, that's an ongoing question and problem.
Right.
But then there's the part, you know, then there's the public facing part. You know, do you want me recording you or wearing glasses that have cameras on them in public? That's a social thing, but it's also, you know, it's also social acceptability and where is that appropriate? To me, that's also about, we already have phones we have phones with cameras, and, you know, you could possibly take photos. I'm not defending the glasses, but I think that's something that's a little more about social acceptance and about whether we even should have the cameras there in the first place. But all of Google's glasses have the cameras, but there are two different types. One are the everyday ones, and then one is more like a shrunken down Vision Pro or VR headset. That one is very interesting. It's called Project Aura, and it's not meant to be worn all the time. It's really, you put it on, you have a lot of extended displays, Android apps, and you could daisy chain and connect your laptop or your phone to basically be working and opening other apps and using Gemini. Kind of like a portable work computer or the future of phones. Yeah, and I found that was really interesting, and you take that off when you're not using it, much like you stop using your computer. That might be more accepting for some people, but it's also a more nerdy niche product.
Yeah.
And the
Yeah, Scott, yeah. I hate to cut you off. We are a little out of time here today. That's my own fault. But the read is great, and you have a lot of this in there. Please come back again soon. We can chat more about this. I'm curious if you think this is going to be the norm in the next 5-10 years, the function, the fashion, how this all collides. You write through it very well at CNET, and I apologize to cut you off a little quick there, Scott.
No, it's okay. Thanks. A lot more to come, and we'll talk more as they come out.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Middle managers' ranks dwindle. Their mandate is increasing. The latest project, apparently, getting you on board with AI. Tim Parody, do you like when I read you to you? Welcome back to WGN.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, it was a great lead and written in very well because, yeah, we've covered, in fact, this week, I believe, about middle managers being asked to be player coaches in addition to being managers or just being gone altogether. And now they're the ones that need to kind of figure out how to get their workers to use AI. I mean, this top-down, you've got to figure out how to make them use AI better. There's got to be some sticky points with this, right?
Sure. I mean, as you just alluded to, there are fewer middle managers at some companies, so that's one thing. It's just more on their to-do list. And also, you know, it's not easy. This is new technology for most people, and so it involves finding ways to actually make it useful for what the company has to do and you know, trying to work through that with workers.
What's at play with the pressure here? Is it that a company is probably invested into AI in some regards financially, and they want to see that return being played out? Is it that they want to be able to tell their clients, hey, we're using AI as almost just kind of checking a box, so let's see something about it? Is it more targeted than that, or is it sometimes just a general, hey, we should be using this stuff?
I'd say it's all of the above. I think it's all those things. There's pressure to use it because of investments companies have made. There's pressure from investors to see that those bets pay off. You know, there are productivity gains to be had, at least a lot of advocates would say. And so it's trying to figure out how to, you know, how to build a better mousetrap with the workers that you have and see if there are ways to make your business operate in a smoother way. And that's not always easy to do. You can do it maybe at an individual level, but then to try to scale that can be difficult.
Yeah, I imagine there's also a fear by the whole thing. If I'm a middle manager go ahead.
Right. No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. I was going to say, absolutely. If you're a worker being told do use AI to do this job better, you start to maybe in the back of your mind wonder a little bit like, you know, is this going to come for me someday? And will this get so efficient that they don't need me or they don't need as many of my colleagues and myself? So there are real questions there.
Obviously, this is up to each individual middle manager, and whatever AI tool is, there's going to be a bunch of different ones. But what is this about? Like, is there going to be some proper training here, I'm assuming? I mean, that's probably what middle managers are asking for. And then how do you track it, right? I mean, you don't want to spy as much as possible on your workers, I'm sure. But what report? Tell me what you did today on AI, almost like Michael Scott had to tell Pam what he was doing every day. Like, how do we do this?
Yeah, nice reference. Yeah, I mean, there are different ways to do it. Certainly, managers are doing this in check-ins and stand-ups with their teams. Some companies have adopted dashboards so you can see not only what you're doing, but what your colleagues are doing. And, you know, they'll often say that this is not meant to be punitive, but to encourage a, you know, culture of experimentation and trying new things. So it's, you know, remains to be seen. But there are different companies and different approaches there.
I mean, yeah, carrot and stick, I think, is appropriate. I wonder, too, to assuage of workers' concerns that he's about to be replaced, he or she, that there can be rewards for, you know, using it more creatively or using it in the best way, not just the most amount of time. And again, that's got to be individually done, but that's probably the challenge of the middle manager is finding the way to thread that needle.
Sure, and I think some of the folks I've talked to have said, you know, we try to make clear that we don't have all the answers here. We're trying to get folks to experiment and, you know, share their successes, share the things that have worked for them in terms of strategies and things that they've tried, and then also share when they've had failures so that they can figure out, you know, we tried this, it didn't really work well. The thing with AI, of course, is it changes so quickly that, you know, what didn't work today might work really well in 3 months, but, you know, it certainly is. For a lot of managers, there's that incentive to try to encourage, you know, people to try new things.
Look, Tim, we've all worked with coasters in the past, and I think you know what I'm talking about. People that do not do 8 hours of work a day or come anywhere close to it, yet they sometimes continue to have a job. And I wonder with AI, if AI helps expose the coaster or if it in fact enables the coaster to do even less work because the 1 hour of stuff they actually did in a day now can be boiled into 15 minutes. I don't know if you got an answer for that, Tim, but that's something that's bouncing in my brain.
It's probably one I'm going to have to think about some more, but I can see both sides. I suppose somebody could get by with doing less work if they were able to get AI to do something for them. But I can also see, you know, we've all seen AI swap or some version of it, right, where we see something that feels clearly manufactured and someone didn't really put much thought into it. So it seems like people might reveal themselves if they're relying too heavily on that.
Yeah. I wonder if there's like a gamification of the AI, too, that could drive people to use it more as an incentive, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, circling back to that idea around, you know, dashboards and things like that, there are certainly, you know, if you see a leaderboard and you're trying to figure out if the guy in the cubicle next to you is using it more than you are, you may, you know, be persuaded by that to dig into it more. So certainly there is that aspect of that competitive, gamification, as you said.
And yeah, and as I think you've pointed out, you know, with middle managers going away, if this is the edict, they will try to deliver and just expect, I don't know, maybe more tension in the office where there's, as pressure is put from top down, that translates into work ethic, that sometimes translates into vibes at a company, the culture of a company. This is going to be kind of difficult a few years as companies figure this out.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I think some people I talk to are excited by this, and other people do kind of have that sense of dread. And again, another thing to do, but this is something that in certain cases will show up in people's performance reviews. There will be metrics, and managers may be going to people and saying, hey, you know, you haven't used AI much in the last month. What's going on?
Yeah, interesting. All right, Tim, we appreciate your time. Tim Parody, Future of Work Correspondent, which is my favorite title of all from Business Insider. Take care. We'll talk soon, okay?
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Apparently, deed theft and seller impersonation fraud is growing and getting more attention. I don't know what those things are. Kathy Kwok does, though, the CEO of Proper Title. Kathy, welcome to WGN.
Hello. It's nice to be here.
I think I might get it a little bit, but before we even get to deed theft, I know, and I host this show, and I host a legal show, and something about the title and the deed just escapes exactly my understanding. So before we even get to the theft of the deed, what is a deed?
Oh, so a deed is the document that conveys property from the seller to the buyer, or the owner, the property owner to the buyer.
Okay.
And that deed is the most important document, if you think about it, in homeownership. Is that you want to confirm that you own the property that you bought and you just either paid in cash for or obtained a loan for.
Is this in my safe or is this like at the county recorder's office?
It could be both. So you'll receive a original wet signed deed that was recorded with the county. You'll most likely receive it from your attorney. That represents you at closing, along with the owner's policy, which is the owner's title insurance policy that's what I'm in the business to sell.
Okay.
And then there is a copy that is made a public record, so you can always search at the Cook County Recorder Deeds website and to look to make sure that your deed has been recorded.
Okay.
There's two ways.
Okay, yeah. So when we say they are stealing the deed, is it a physical stealing or a theft, or what is happening?
Oh, yeah.
What's the actual mechanism?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the stealing actually is impersonating the owner of the property and claiming that they are the owner of the property. And so when the transaction happens, the fraudster walks away with money and the buyer thinking that now they have just purchased the home from the owner of the property when in fact it was the fraudster. So it is not a conveyance that, and even if it's made a public record, it doesn't matter because this seller it wasn't the correct seller. So the conveyance never happened. And
okay.
So the, yeah.
How do they do that? Like, what do you mean?
Yeah,
what do you mean they pretend to be me and then they sell my house? Like how?
I know. So most of these properties that are being targeted are ones that are not really being lived in, right? So there's not a lot of attention. Usually the mortgage has been paid off. So in most instances, these vacant land, and land will include not only just a piece of land that doesn't even have a home on it or any sort of structure, but it also could be where there's a home, but no one has been living in it. Perhaps it's a second home. Perhaps it's a generational home where the parents have, you know, passed and the children own it or the heirs, and no one is really overseeing it, let's say, because there's other things that are happening in their lives.
Right.
So it's not a priority. And so these fraudsters are searching the public records, and it's very easy to Google now, right, to see what the state of the property is. And they can also go online because mortgages are recorded, and they can also see what kind of judgments or liens that are on certain property.
Okay.
And so specifically for vacant land, that is what properties are being targeted.
Okay, so then when they impersonate me, I'm John Hanson. I know my name.
Yes.
Does that mean that they are creating a fake ID that says they're John Hanson, or are they changing the name on the deed to their name and then they have the authority to do it? Like, I'm just curious about like the X's and O's of how they actually do it.
Yeah, so these fraudsters are getting really, really good. I remember when this first kind of came up, where it was a hot trending topic. It's not trend in a good way, by the way. It's probably neon or 80s wear that we always make fun of, but it's that bad negative trend that started happening maybe like 2-3 years ago. And at first it was just vacant land. The fraudster would reach out to, they wouldn't even check the tax bills, because many second homes, the tax bills will go to the owner that's most likely living out of state, mm-hmm. and they don't live in Chicago. And so they target that, because then there's not much oversight. And so what they do is they pretend and they impersonate the seller by reaching out to possibly a listing agent. And they do a lot of research on the listing agent to see, maybe not a high-end broker, maybe a busy broker, gather, okay, who is going to pay the least attention and just make this go through?
Like, so they call
meeting in person.
Right. Yeah. So they call a broker and say, I'm John Hanson. I own this property. I want to sell my place. And the broker is too busy. They're inexperienced. And they go, oh, this is great.
Yeah. And so they're like, oh, let me connect you to my assistant or someone else on my team. Many times it happens that way. And then the team is handling it. It's just a small property, maybe $100,000. And I'm not saying $100,000. $100,000 is a little amount at
no,
all.
Yeah.
But fraudsters always start small,
right?
To see, they want to learn. They want to learn from a situation, and they do not give up.
I want to play this to the end, though.
$100,000.
Yeah. So, they say we're going to sell it for this. The fraudster, the fake John Hanson, shows up at the closing. The buyers
will not show up at the closing. In the Chicago metro area, it's very common for the sellers not to be present at the closing. They are represented by an attorney, and the attorney will pre-sign documents, including a power of attorney. So it gives the authority for the attorney to go to attend the closing and sign all the documents on their behalf. So you have to understand that there are these layers, and fraudsters are really good. So they are able to, they never do FaceTime. They will never want to meet. They'll do everything virtually. They might request remote online notarization, just anything to get a power of attorney approved by an attorney, right? And then the attorney will go through with the transaction. The listing agent will show up most likely at all times for a walkthrough to just be there representing the property. And it's just as if it's a normal transaction.
And then the fraudster gets the check.
No one knows that this person is a fraudster.
The fraudster gets the check at the end of the day. So is the victim? You're doing great, Kathy, by the way. I'm sorry this is so agonizing for you. I'm just trying to speed it along because we're almost out of time, and I want to get to the beat of it. But so is this really a crime against the buyers more so than the seller, right? Because the seller really still owns the house. Like, I still own that property even if this guy faked it.
Yes, but that's when there's title insurance that comes into play. So both parties are affected. So here's a seller that's saying, we still own the property. Here's a buyer. The buyer might sue the seller, being like, how did you not know that you were selling the property? We're owed a home. We made plans.
Yeah, it's crazy.
We want to raise a family.
It's crazy.
And so the buyer will be able to file a claim for a full title loss. So although they won't get the home, they will at least get their money back.
Okay.
That's why you have title insurance. So that's how the buyer is made whole. The seller has been defrauded.
Yeah.
Someone has been impersonating him. So that's when we file a police report with the local police, but really it's the FBI. Because the FBI has a whole unit about, you know, fraud, this deed fraud or seller impersonation, right. Vacant land. It's across the U.S. And
Kathy,
Chicago is just very specific. Yeah.
I got to cut you off. I'm so sorry. I made this so much longer than it needed to be, but I understand it now.
Yeah.
And I think we should follow up on how to protect it soon. PropertTitle.com, where people can reach out to you guys. You're the CEO.
Yes,
Kathy, I got to go, but thank you so much for explaining it to me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a great day. It was nice talking with you.